You don't know the number one radio station in Bristol, Ujima 98 FM.
Ujima, 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 Ujima
98 FM.
Treasure when you treasure all that's new and true and gay.
The heart of Bristol.
Keep on moving. You're listening to Ujima 98 FM.
Massive, you know me, say boom!
And hello, welcome to Ujima Radio 98 FM, Bristol's number one urban station. You are listening to the Women's Outlook Show at noon, and I'm your host, Cheryl Morgan. We have a packed show for you today. We have some fabulous guests coming into the studio. But first of all, I want to introduce the topic for the first hour with a little piece of music. Now that, of course, was Janelle Monáe from her album Metropolis. That was the opening track. And the reason I played that was nothing to do with science fiction, listeners. We're not talking about that today. But because Janelle Monáe's albums are all about telling stories with music. Stories and music have gone together since time immemorial. A bard, for example, means both somebody who sings and somebody who tells stories. And in an ancient Celtic society, they absolutely did both. I would be prepared to take a bet that when Homer was telling people stories about the Greek heroes, he probably had some sort of musical instrument to accompany what he was doing. Now, in modern days, of course, we tell stories with music through musicals. But the big thing about stories and music is opera. And the first hour of our show is going to be all about opera. Now, don't panic, people. We're not going to subject you to large numbers of very large people singing in Italian and German and whatever. Promise you this will be accessible. And to help us with this, we have in the studio the fabulous Cian Lester. Hello, Cian.
Hey, Cheryl. How's it going?
It's good, thank you. So Cian has come all the way up from London to join us today and tell us a little bit about the history of opera. When you think of opera, you tend to think of born and upper-class people and everything being terribly expensive. It gives you the impression that if you can't rock up to the gig in a Rolls-Royce, they probably won't let you in.
Mm.
But back in the 16th century, when opera started in Italy, it was much more of a popular culture thing.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I think it's very interesting you started off by talking about bards, because opera, literally, it just means a work. It means a whole. And it used to be called Dramatica per musica, drama with music, drama through music. There's nothing fancy about it. I mean, we could talk about opera now, sort of in its beginnings. We could talk about musical theater. We could talk about concept albums. We could talk about making music videos. All it is somebody wants to express some emotions. You've got a bit of a story with it, although some operas don't have much of a story. It's much more like linking scenes, again, more like a music album. And you're telling it in sort of between an hour to an hour and a half, 2 hours, through arias, which early on in the genre could be very short. They can be anything between 1.5 minutes down to sort of 6 minutes long. So I don't think there's anything particular about opera that makes it that distinct from any other form of music, where you're saying, look, I have some emotions, I've got some musicality I want to express. Blow your audience's socks off. I mean, that's it, really.
I mean, thank you for reminding me about concept albums, because I was sadly addicted to that back in the 70s. I used to buy things by people like Rick Wakeman and whatever, which again, were very much telling stories with songs.
Well, but like someone like Janelle Monáe, you know, or Beyoncé, sort of in her recent works, have definitely been using that same idea that, you know, you have linking threads, you might be telling narratives through your works, the musical themes might sort of come back and mirror each other at different parts of the album. And I really don't see how that's different. I mean, I think you have different ways of expressing yourself musically, but at the end of the day, you're doing the same thing.
Okay, well, let's take ourselves back to Italy then, and I think 17th century now, that one of the big stars of early opera was actually a woman composer.
Yeah, she was born in the late 16th century and was composing in the very early 17th century, and this is Francesca Caccini. And her father was a famous composer, so she did start off with a running start. But actually, by I think it was 1614, she was the highest paid musician at the Medici court. There's this really strange idea that women weren't involved in musical history. I mean, certainly I remember when I was at school and I asked about female composers, sometimes my male teacher sort of laughed and went, oh, don't be so stupid, there aren't any female composers. And he shook his head and went, I suppose it's Clara Schumann. But you actually go and look at it, and they were all over the place. And, you know, Caccini, she was famed throughout Europe. She was paid really well. She worked at different courts. She worked both as a teacher, a composer, and as a performer. Apparently, she had an amazing singing voice. And she wrote this opera called The Liberation of Ruggiero from the Island of the Sorceress Alcina, which was a satire. It was a complete send-up of sort of pompous, over-the-top ideas of what music should be, but she managed to mix that with really beautiful, sympathetic vocal writing, and apparently it was so popular it was sort of repeated by several different monarchs throughout Europe. They were all desperate to get a piece of it.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, Caccini worked for Maria Maddalena, who was the Archduchess of Austria.
Yes.
She was married to Cosimo de' Medici, but she was an Austrian Archduchess and regent of Austria in her own right. So again, it's a woman ruler commissioning a woman to write this opera.
Absolutely, and there's some evidence that Caccini wrote music specifically for all female gatherings, which would be sort of women intellectuals and artists sort of sitting around making music, listening to songs. She also wrote what we would now consider to be pop songs, as did a lot of the musicians of the day. Monteverdi did this, Purcell did this, Dowland did this. 1 to 4 minute songs that you could accompany yourself on the lute or on the baroque guitar, and you would sing to small gatherings. You could sing them in the streets. They were the popular music of the time, and it's very strange that we're now looking back historically and calling it classical music. It's just a period of time. It's not a distinction that would have been made.
When I was looking up Caccini's opera on the internet, one of the interesting things about it was that they said it was very much a story about gender. It's a story. I mean, the central character, Ruggiero, is obviously male, but the other two main characters are two women, one of whom, Alcina the witch, is very sexy and rather evil. And then there's Melissa, who is good and adopts a more androgynous persona.
Yeah, this is something which we see throughout opera history, particularly early opera, is it's a forum in which to sort of talk about gender, play with gender. Again, we seem to have cultural amnesia about this. Singers at the time, coming in from the church and then sort of moving onwards, there were an awful lot of castrati singers who were people who would have been assigned male at birth and then either through their own volition or, sadly, because of their parents' choice, would have been castrated around the age of puberty to retain a high voice and then would have gone on as adults to develop a sort of very androgynous appearance and a very androgynous sound. Now, these were the highest paid singers in Baroque opera, even coming through to early classical music. As were some of the most famous were women who wore men's clothes and would play men on stage, seduce women. The librettos at the time are full of innuendo, sort of things like, I don't know what it's like to be a man, but I don't know what it's like to be a woman, but I love you, or that kind of real, you know, sort of lots of really terrible puns relating to swords and spears and other kind of things. So yeah, in The Liberation of Ruggiero, you have Alcina and Ruggiero, who by the caudal scheme are positioned as binary male and binary female. And then you have Melissa, who is cross-dressed as the warrior Atalantis, and she's positioned in between them, tonally speaking. And they kind of all travel in between these different parts of the music, and they explore different aspects of themselves through changing sort of harmonic tones.
And it would have been perfect. You could sing Melissa, I could sing Alcina.
Exactly.
The only problem with that is that people have been known to dial 999 when I try to sing.
You could mime along in the best tradition.
Yeah, right. We'll come back to talking about castrati and things in a little while,
sure.
But we have some actual opera to play very shortly, and it's actually by a black opera singer,
Noah Stewart.
You know, people tend not to associate people of colour with opera, but again, I suspect there have been rather more than we know about.
It is. It's been a very long history, and it's odd being in the classical music field because you have a mix of some of the most progressive, radical people that you know, and then some very, very conservative elements. I mean, there certainly is a part of opera which is quite unbelievably racist, and that refuses to die as quickly as it should do. But there have been British black composers, I think, since the late 19th century that we're aware of. They're probably an awful lot more in Tudor times when you think of actually the number of people from Africa in Europe is being grossly underestimated by many historians, and it's very likely that some of them worked in the arts just as a percentage. But certainly in the 20th century, some of the greatest opera singers have been black. I mean, Leontine Price, who's a personal hero of mine, and as I found out the other day, a personal hero of Laverne Cox, which made me so happy I almost died. Sorry, am I babbling on?
No, not at all. But, we do need to get on with things. So let us have some actual opera.
Yes.
This is from Puccini's Tosca, and this is Noah Stewart. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Ujima Radio 98 FM, Britain's number one urban station. This is the Women's Outlook Show with Cheryl Morgan. And just before the ads, we were listening to Noah Stewart, who is a black opera singer. He was born in Harlem in New York, worked his way up through the education system there, and has become a big opera star around the world. And he was singing a tune from Tosca by Puccini. Tosca is a story essentially about a love affair between an artist and a singer. Tosca,
yes,
being the singer, yeah?
Kind of. I mean, it's my favourite opera, apart from Dido and Aeneas, so I could go on about this all day long. I think it's a really great introduction, actually. If you've never been to an opera, find out a production of Tosca and go and see it, because it's Puccini. It was called, when it first premiered, A Shabby Little Shocker. It's three main characters. You've got Tosca, who's this incredible diva. Her lover, Mario, who is an artist but also a revolutionary, and you have Scarpia, who's the chief of police in Rome in the police state, and Scarpia is madly in love with Tosca, but in a cruel and sadistic and evil way. So he arrests her lover Mario and tries to torture him to death, saying to Tosca, well, if you sleep with me, I won't torture your lover to death. Tosca's having none of this, so she just about agrees and then stabs Scarpia in the back, and obviously it all ends horribly in tragedy. She ends up killing herself, everything, but it has some of the best arias. It's such high passion, but it's also making a really sort of quite deep political point against state repression, against police repression, and really, again, that basic point that opera often comes back to, that love is the most important thing. And she dies for love, and he dies for love, and actually, in the end of the day, they triumph. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, yeah, and an awful lot of opera seems to be everybody dies at the end.
Yeah, that is pretty much, yeah.
On the other hand, they do different stuff as well.
Yes.
I mean, you look at, say, Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, I mean, that's basically a farce.
Absolutely. No, I mean, we call them sort of opera buffa or opera seria. You've got sort of, yeah, funny opera, serious opera. And so, yeah, half of it seems like everyone dies in the end, and the other half is everyone's desperately trying to get romantic with everybody else. And romantic, I would do so euphemistically, and sings an awful lot of sort of very beautiful, more light kind of music with lots of cheap gags and, you know, running off stage and being in costume and that kind of stuff. Kind of reminds you of the difference in Shakespeare, certainly for me, the comedies and the tragedies. You've got both there.
And Shakespeare is actually something I was just about to come back to, because listeners will probably know that in Shakespeare's day, women were not allowed on stage.
Mm.
So all of the roles of the women in Shakespearean plays had to be played by young boys.
Mm.
So when you got Romeo and Juliet, actually, two young boys together. And all of that stuff in things like Twelfth Night with girls dressed as boys gets very, very strange very quickly. Mm.
Which you have exactly the same thing in opera. So Mozart, Marriage of Figaro, there's a huge tradition in opera. So we not only had the castrati who would be playing male and female roles, but you had women playing male and female roles. And so someone like Cherubino in the opera, he's a teenage boy, played by a mezzo-soprano who is female. But during the opera, Cherubino gets dressed up as a girl, and the other characters go, oh my goodness, how funny it is that Cherubino looks so pretty as a girl. Ho ho, he's a boy. Ho ho, look at the audience. Or is he really? Wink. Kind of thing. You know, it can be very silly, but also fun.
Yeah, and we seem to have lost a lot of that.
I think we have. I think we've lost the idea that opera is, it's almost got like a carnival nature. You know, anything goes, and people wear masks, and it's somewhere to explore different parts of what it means to be human. And because they're talking about love and relationships so much, by necessity, they're going to be talking about gender and sexuality as well.
Of course, one of the things that keeps people away from opera in this country is that so much of it is sung in other languages. Is there stuff that people can find that's more accessible because
Absolutely.
They can understand the words?
Yeah, no, I mean, the one thing is that most operas will have surtitles, which I think for the first 5 minutes, it seems a bit strange to be listening to one thing and reading the titles above. After that, you completely forget. I mean, if you can watch, what, Borgen or The Killing and forget that it's in Scandinavian, you can definitely sort of watch opera. But then things like English National Opera and Opera North, Welsh National Opera, they do an awful lot of stuff in English anyway. And actually, most singers' diction is really good, so you can hear what's going on. And I think sometimes at the end of the day, you don't even need to know the words. Like, if you know the plot beforehand, and usually the plots are quite simple. Like Carmen, you don't need to know the words. She's a bad girl. He's the good boy led astray. Everyone dies. Again, you know, it's, seduction happens. Everyone gets sad. Murder. Done.
We have Judeline in the studio with us as well, and she's been sat here listening patiently to all this talk about opera. Have we persuaded you that you might like to go and see an opera?
I think, in fact, the first opera I ever saw was when I was living in Tripoli.
And
there was a big post-war Italian community. And I'm sure in that sort of years back memory, going to something, and I have been to opera in Bristol. Part of it is that shying off because of what you perceive as elitism, you know, your background, your own education. But I just love the drama. I think my first opera in Bristol was Aida. You know, so it's a drama. And as you were saying, it's, you know, if you can understand the plot, it's fairly, you know, good guy, bad guy, love, romance, heartache. But the actual visual and the passion of it caught me.
If anyone's seen Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge, I think that's probably a really good way of looking at opera. It is pretty much like that. You've got this amazing visual spectacle, really lush music. And if you just let yourself just kind of get washed away by it, don't think too hard. Don't try and analyze it or worry about it. Just go with it and see if you like it. And while opera does have a problem with elitism, absolutely, there are also an awful lot of people in opera who aren't from backgrounds you would expect, and lots of musicians don't come from rich backgrounds, and lots of operas, in fact nearly all operas in the country, have tickets for £5 to £10. They have different schemes if you're unemployed, if you're a student, if you sort of young people under the age of 16, free opera ticket schemes. It's worth looking on the website, because I don't have a huge amount of money and I go to the opera all the time, and it's cheaper than going to rock gigs. I usually buy £10, £12 seats. So
that's definitely cheaper than going to rock gigs.
Exactly.
So is there a lot of opera being written today?
Yes, there is. And actually, coming back, talking about black singers, one thing which is very exciting is we've had Toni Morrison's birthday was the other day, and she actually wrote a libretto for City Opera, I think it was, in New York a couple of years ago. So there's definitely some really exciting progress in new opera in terms of widening demographics. There's a festival in London called the Tête-à-Tête Opera Festival, which specializes in working with new composers. So a friend of mine, she wrote an opera based on a folk tale. And it was just for, I think, four singers. It only lasted 45 minutes, so it was a really interesting introduction. Cost £5 to get in and see, like, five operas that were all 45 minutes long and have a drink. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, just you can rock up and just see if you like it.
Mm. One of the things that interests me about opera is that quite often they weren't written from scratch. I mean, Marriage of Figaro, for example, is based on a play, and the play is actually a sequel to the play on which the Barbara Seville is.
Absolutely.
Barbara Seville was
That was Rossini.
Rossini, right. Mm-hmm. So Rossini writes an opera based on one play, and then Mozart writes an opera based on another play, and actually common characters between the two. So.
Exactly. I mean, the sort of timing's a little different. So the Mozart came first and then the Rossini. I think I say that. My brain's gone blank. I'm so sorry if I actually just got that totally wrong. There's this idea, again, that opera is so highbrow that it's kind of like a perfect play that gets written and everyone sits there dripping inspiration from their brow. It was often as common as just going, this book or this play is selling really well. How do we get in on the money? It would be like watching, I don't know, Transformers movie and going, that's all tickets, I'm making an opera of that.
That is exactly what it reminded me of. The opera was the big budget thing of the day, and if there was anything popular in theatre or whatever, then an opera producer would come along and say, we're going to do that. And it's the equivalent of Hollywood coming on and saying, we're going to do a movie of this comic book or this novel.
My friends and I keep joking we need to write a Game of Thrones opera and just make it like proper death metal opera.
Brilliant.
Just like
absolutely
a Skyrim crossover opera.
I'll have words with George about it. Okay, well, just to wrap up this particular section of the show, I want to bring in Noah Stewart again, and just to prove that opera singers can turn their hands to absolutely everything and make it sound absolutely amazing, here's Noah Stewart with a little bit of ABBA. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Ujima Radio 98 FM, Bristol's number one urban station. This is the Women's Outlook Show, and I'm Cheryl Morgan. We have been talking here about opera to C.N. Lester. And, of course, C.N., as well as being an expert on opera, is also an opera singer, mezzo-soprano, I believe.
That's the one.
And somebody who has performed in a lot of opera over the time. I gather that you were involved with a group called Entrevesti at some point.
Yes, I was the creative director, and we did that for 3 years, specialising in sort of gender issues, particularly in early music. So female composers, castrati roles, ontravesti roles, which would be, ontravesti literally means in disguise, and that's sort of when you have women playing men on stage. It was really fantastic. We got to do work at the British Library and with sort of Handel House and making new editions of performing works, and since then I've sort of gone on to keep the same focus but on sort of solo terms.
Right, and you've also been involved with Cambridge Early Music?
Yes, that was a fun time. We did lots of Bach with them, and so most recently working with Silent Opera, which was a great deal of fun. We did improv opera at the Bush Theatre and got on Radio 4, which was always nice when you're singing opera about going to Poundland and not being able to find... not being able to find like a dish scrubber. No, that was really good. And at the moment I'm working with the musical director from Opera Up Close, which won the Olivier's a couple of years back, and we're doing a new version of Bellini's Romeo and Juliet. So I'm playing Romeo in 2 weeks' time. Which
you
is super
are
fun.
Playing Romeo.
I'm playing Romeo.
I'm swept off my feet.
It's going to be so exciting. I get to wear like a silk jacket and black breeches and knee boots and everything.
Okay.
There's a lot of striding.
Now, in addition to all the opera, you also make your own music.
Mm, yes.
So I think we should probably listen to some of your own stuff now, if we have space. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you.
that was Ashes, which is the title track of one of C.N. Lester's albums. C.N., would you like us to, like to tell us a little bit about that album?
Yeah, that was actually my debut alternative album, which came out, 2 years ago now. I've just signed off on the next one, which is coming out on March 22nd. So it really is that long ago. And yeah, I mean, as you can hear, it was a very quiet little album. We didn't really want to do much with it. We just recorded it in my living room on my childhood piano. The engineer came down. We spent sort of 4 days locked in my living room and hopefully produced something quite intimate and small scale. The next one's a little bit louder, a little bit sort of grittier and dirtier, but
yeah, well, I'm very much looking forward to the next one, which is called Ether, which you ran a Kickstarter campaign for.
I did, and we just finished. We came £300 over budget, which is amazing, which means that we'll pay off the Kickstarter fees, and also mean I can put a little bit more money into paying the artists who are helping with the music videos and the posters and the promotion, which is always a joy.
Kickstarter and things like it appear to be very popular these days for funding various art projects. I'm probably going to do a book with Kickstarter later in the year. How have you found it?
I've loved it. I mean, I think the fact for me, it gives you that ability to stick to your sort of guns in terms of artistic integrity. I think I found, we were talking a little bit earlier, because of being trans, I've had a few people who I've worked with who wanted me to go a very specific direction, which I wasn't comfortable in. The whole, like, sell your before and after pictures, do a sob story, stuff that has absolutely no place in what I want to do. And so being able to say to my fans, would you like a new album? And they say yes. And then it gets made. And that's all there is to it. And it means that I can be accountable just to basically what they want to hear and what I want to make. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, we've let the cat out of the bag a little bit. So we should remind listeners that we are still in February. It is still LGBT History Month, in which we're celebrating the works of lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people. And you are a trans person.
Yes.
That, I understand, has affected your music.
Yeah, I think it has, insofar as it's always very interesting talking to people, so what language do you use? And I would describe myself using language that both relates to being sort of transmasculine, but also being kind of androgynous or genderqueer. I love music. I knew since I was tiny that I was going to be a musician. And when I was a teenager, certainly the information out there was if you took testosterone, it would ruin your voice. So I had to stay away from testosterone, which meant I couldn't go down the NHS route for treatment. So I paid for the treatment that I've had privately. And while there's certainly sort of a lot more research being done now into the effects of testosterone on the voice, and in fact, I'm doing some of the research, which is absolutely fascinating. And there are signs that people, particularly if you've got a good teacher, you're training well, that you might well be able to take testosterone and wait for the voice to settle and emerge with a sort of a tenor or a bass or a baritone voice. That wasn't really an option open to me, so it was a case of keeping my voice and having to deal with the sort of constant misgendering, which is not fun, but at the same point, when you're on stage with your whole body throbbing, like throbbing with music, getting those high notes out there, I couldn't give that up, so...
But as you were saying, the fact that you are trans has made it difficult to get work in the field.
Yeah, it can do. I mean, again, I don't want to dismiss the people I've met who've been amazing. I have an incredible singing teacher. And you know, it's one of these things I think you meet. 85% of people are great. They might not know the correct words. They might not, you know, sort of be a bit unsure about how to approach things, but they're supportive and interested. Unfortunately, then you sort of have, you do have some bigoted people, and it's... Yeah, there have been people who would refuse to hire me or be sort of out and out discriminatory. But, you know, we all just have to keep fighting against it. And I think one of the ways of fighting against it is to talk about it and make it not a taboo. And definitely for myself, because I am out, I would rather people came to me and asked questions so that then the next time they meet a trans person, they feel a bit more prepared.
No man to get her through this. She said, I'm tired of the war. I want the kind of work I had before, a wedding dress or something white to wear upon my I saw the glory.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Ujima Radio 98 FM, Bristol's number one urban station. This is the Women's Outlook Show with Cheryl Morgan. And returning for our final segment with our guest in the studio, C.N. Lester. That track that you've just heard was Joan of Arc from the album Ashes. Now, there are other albums that you have out there, Dark Angels, for example.
Yes, Dark Angels I made end of 2012, beginning of 2013 with my classical duo partner, Toby Carr. It's very weird as a young singer because your voice changes so dramatically month by month that even now this album's a little bit out of date in terms of how I sound, but I'm still really proud of it. And it's songs for voice and guitar, primarily by gay composers, actually, which fits in nicely. So Peter Maxwell Davies is the main composer on that album. He's a master of the Queen's music, and he has been out and proud for a very long time. There are definitely people doing it, and, you know, hats off to anyone who does.
Yeah, and that, of course, brings us back to the whole theme of this month's programmes of LGBT History Month, and we've been going through that. We've been playing, for example, Noah Stewart, who is an openly gay black opera singer, and we've been playing CN's own music, and CN is openly trans.
And bi, I get, like, the two end letters.
It's fantastic. There you go.
I'm one step away from a BLT sandwich.
Alrighty. So if people are interested in your music, if they've been inspired by what they've heard, how can they keep in touch? How can they find your work?
They can go to www.cnlester.com or just follow me on Twitter at CN Lester. Just Google will bring it up, frankly, on Facebook. And I have a blog called A Gentleman and a Scholar, which is mostly on trans issues. And actually, I do a series called Transpose, which promotes the works of trans artists and trans allied artists. So you don't need to be trans to perform, but you do need to be supportive. And actually, our next gig is at Tate Modern on April the 6th. So if that sounds like your kind of evening, a free evening at Tate Modern, listening to trans artists, talking about the collection, drinking some wine, stroking your imaginary beard and feeling quite wise and arty, the tickets actually go on sale any day now. So check that on social media.
Yeah, well, that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. Of course, it's up in London.
It is up in London. I'll be playing in Bristol, hopefully, with Lickety Split in May.
Whoa.
So that should be fun.
Yes,
I think May the 16th is what we're hoping for.
Okay, well, do keep me informed about that so that I can warn people and get their tickets in advance, and I will certainly be along to listen to it if I can.
Thank you.
Okay, so just for the last few minutes that we've got, we should come back to the topic of opera and what people can do. And Judeline, I know you had some concerns about going along to opera events.
I think it's that stereotype, as we were saying earlier, about the images, the stereotype, the cliché that you can only go to opera if you're dressed up in ball gown and, you know, twinkly diamonds and your man in his tux. But I understand that you take an alternative view, going after work in your jeans and just going for it.
That's the one. Yeah? I mean, if you go and get one of the cheap seats, which will be up right at the top of the opera house, you get a great view of the stage. Lots of the people up there are going to be music students and working musicians, and we all just wear whatever we've been wearing for the rest of the day. I've seen people at the opera wearing their pajamas under a coat, you know. Honestly, yeah, I mean, if you want to get dressed up, go for it. Like, we use it as an excuse, but most people are just there wearing their work clothes or whatever they just happen to have on. It's not, it's dark anyway. They turn the lights down. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, nobody will notice.
Nobody will notice. You're there for the music. You're not there to parade.
And is there anything, I mean, I'm not a big expert in opera. Do you know anything about what might be coming up in Bristol?
Let's see what's coming up in Bristol. There will be some performances of Welsh National Opera, I think, tours in Bristol. And they've got some fantastic, fantastic series coming up. I think they're focusing on scandalous women in opera. And they're having some talks. They're doing some new works. So go and check out the Welsh National Opera website. If I'm correct, I think they play at the Bristol Hippodrome.
Yeah.
And they're a fantastic company.
Yeah.
And again, they do great cheap ticket schemes. Just go along for the evening, see if you like it.
And presumably the Welsh National Opera is relatively easily accessible just over the bridge in Cardiff as
well. Exactly, yes. I mean, they play, I think, Cardiff, Llandudno, sort of all around sort of Wales and the southwest.
I am displaying some national pride here.
Oh, complete. Well, you can't tell from the accent, but my family's Welsh, so, you know.
I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly. Welsh pride. My Nana's listening. Yeah. Hey, Nana.
Yeah. Already. And indeed, if anybody from the Welsh rugby team is listening, good luck for Saturday, boys. All right. Well, we have just a few minutes left, Cian, so maybe we can talk a little bit more about the trans stuff.
Sure.
Because you have been quite an important trans activist.
Yeah, I when I was a teenager, it was LGBT, but they were called gay straight alliances. So I started the first one in the UK at my school, which did not go down well with my school, who tried to sue me.
Wow.
Luckily, I had parents who stepped into the breach and fought my corner. And then myself and David Henry co-founded Queer Youth Network, which was called Queer Youth Overground at the time, which was the first nationwide group run for and by young LGBT people. So that's been going well ever since 2000, which is kind of incredible. I stepped out after a couple of years, but it's still going. Events, marches, letters, meetings, bothering people.
Yeah,
bothering
sure.
people to be nicer. That's
yeah,
the plan.
Yeah, no, but bothering people to be nicer is a very good thing to be doing. This is Cheryl Morgan, and you have been listening to an excerpt from the Women's Outlook show on Ujima Radio 98 FM. Women's Outlook is produced and hosted by Paulette North, and is broadcast every Wednesday between noon and 2 p.m. The show is available for streaming and as a podcast from the Ujima website at www.ujimaradio.com. That's ujimaradio.com. Thank you for listening.